This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A quick trip through YouTube or the international press shows a really creative wave of public protest in England and Scotland. How do they do it? You can find out with a new behind-the-scenes film called Just Do It. The filmmaker was trained at Britain's National Film and Television School. She was executive producer of the well-known climate change picture The Age of Stupid. Radio EcoShock welcomes Emily James. Hello, Emily.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, since I've not yet seen Just Do It, nobody has, I expect, beyond the trailer on the net, please tell us what we can expect.
Right, so the film covers a year in the life of a community of diverse activists drawn from Climate Camp and Plain Stupid, which are, if you're not familiar with them, two quite large direct action groups in the UK. Climate Camp holds large-scale camps, using tents in public spaces to kind of hold autonomous spaces. And Plain Stupid did a number of actions such as shutting down Stansted Airport and getting on top of doing a banner drop from the roof of Parliament, both of which have been sort of quite well known internationally. So I followed them for a year in the run-up to Copenhagen Conference and then for a little while after that, which was a very active year for them. And the film has now been put together into a feature documentary, which will be coming out in America, we hope, early next year.
How did you get the confidence of these young activists to be invited in at the planning stages before the big day?
Well, that was indeed probably one of the biggest challenges of the entire project. When I first started approaching people in Plain Stupid and Climate Camp, they were incredibly hesitant. I mean, Plain Stupid said outright no for 6 months, that they just couldn't participate. And the reason for that was quite obvious, because what I was asking was, can I amass a whole body of material that could potentially be used against you in court to prove a giant conspiracy case? And so, you know, understandably, they were very hesitant. I went away and did a lot of homework. I was lucky enough to get a huge amount of pro bono advice from a legal firm that works with direct action activists representing them. They were, through the advice that I got from them, I was then able to kind of piece together what I called my security protocol. And this ranged from promising the activists that none of the footage would come out before all of their court cases were finished, which I achieved by keeping everything in a safe house, not connected to me or any of them. Because one of the key things that I learned was, if the authorities couldn't get their hands on the material, it would be very hard for them to use it in the system. And the other way that I kept people safe was by not keeping any written records of what I was filming or logs of the tapes, because that would have made a very easy subpoena for the authorities if they had come across that. Every time I went out on an action filming with them, I'd have to completely clear my house and office of anything that had to do with the film, because if I were arrested alongside them, the authorities could get a warrant to search my premises quite easily. So there's quite a lot of safety and security that I put in place. But then I think beyond that, it was an extensive process of getting to know people and gaining their trust. So it wasn't about convincing people to participate. It was about building real relationships with them so that they then wanted to be involved.
Tell us about filming at the climate camp, keeping in mind many of our North American listeners have never heard of a climate camp.
Exactly. So, I mean, climate camps, they've done five of them, big, large scales and some small ones. But the big ones, they construct very large, you know, almost like a festival or something, these very large camps using big tents and small tents, and everything's very sustainable on site. So it's all vegan food in the kitchens, it's grey water recycling, it's compost toilets and all of that. But the tricky thing about it is that they put these camps up without permission in spaces where they are not allowed to do so. So there's frequently shall we say, some disagreements with the authorities about whether they should have these camps in place. And some of the camps have experienced quite an extreme level of policing, with people being stopped and searched as they were coming and going, with multiple arrests, with physical attempts to remove the camps and that sort of thing. So that was quite tricky from that side of things. And on the other side, because of the nature, the camps are training camps for direct action. You know, this is basically people go there, they meet other people, they come up with plans, and then on, and then they use that camp as a launching pad to go and launch actions, whether it be, depending on which camp it is, against, there was a camp that was right next to Heathrow Airport, there was another camp that was right next to a large coal-fired power station. So, you know, because people are planning direct action in these camps, they're not very keen to have cameras wandering about just filming whatever they like. So there was a huge amount of negotiation between the campers and people like myself and people who were involved in documenting the camp. But in the end, I think we managed to capture the essence of what they were doing.
That almost sounds like the origins of the Occupy movement. You know, Emily, it seems sometimes like the greatest days of activist stunts and banner hangings are almost over in North America, and I'm not sure why. The corporate media is less cooperative. The terrorist scare after 9/11 made many people duck their heads. But the UK has both those problems and still persists in public actions. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that your nod to the Occupy movement at the beginning of the question is very key, because I think there we see things beginning to change in America around this, you know, people's willingness to engage in this kind of activity. But you're right, during the last sort of 5 to 6 years post 9/11, a lot of this is, you know, there was a groundswell that was moving before that that really has gone quiet. And we've suffered from similar things here in the UK. I mean, the counterterrorism legislation that was passed in this country has been used against everything from students protesting in the street to plain stupid to climate camp. And in fact, it's the same branch of the police that polices direct action activists as polices domestic terrorists. So this has been a major issue. And in fact, there has recently last year come out a number of stories about undercover police who the authorities had put in place for years on end. So these are deep cover police. So, you know, this is a huge amount of public expense which is being put out to police people who ultimately are just trying to get people to address climate change and other environmental issues, and there's been a massive outcry against that.
So do you see your new film, Just Do It, as kind of a seed that will pass on some of the techniques and problems of that kind of activism?
Well, I suppose I hope so. I did this film because I could see that the story of this moment in time of direct action against climate change, groups like Climate Camp and Plain Stupid, that their story just really wasn't being captured and wasn't going to be told. So it was, as a filmmaker, I found myself in a position where I thought I could make it happen, and it just seemed like I had a responsibility to capture their story, you know, for posterity and to give them their place in history, I think. But I think that what I've seen since the film has started coming out here in the UK is that it is indeed having effects similar to what you describe. I mean, both, I met somebody recently who had seen it when it came out in the cinemas in July, and she told me that since then she had gotten heavily involved with an anti-fracking group here in the UK called Frack Off, and that she had been arrested for the first time as well on one of their actions. And she had never done anything like that before she saw the film. So it clearly had that effect for her. And I'm pleased about that, because I think that what they're doing is a valuable contribution. And a lot of the reason why I wanted to make the film was really to counteract the way that these people were being portrayed in the media, you know, in the news media. There was this paper-thin narrative of them just sort of, you know, being a bunch of hippies and or layabouts or, you know, and it was just a kind of, they were being vilified. And I thought, well, all I've really got to do is show what they're really like to people, and a lot of that will be undone. And that's been, you know, really the case as well. We've had an amazing response here. So, yes, I hope as the film goes out into the rest of the world now, we'll begin to see all kinds of stories coming back to us about how it inspires different people to do different things.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with Emily James, a filmmaker with a new piece about activism. Emily, I also wonder whether student debt holds a lot of people back. People think they have to have a squeaky clean record to get the corporate jobs to pay it all back, and of course millions of them never get work in that field anyway. What's the situation in the UK, and how does that relate to protest?
Well, yes, I think you're right about the way that student debt has affected people in North America. Absolutely. And unfortunately, we're on the road taking us to a similar direction because this country has agreed, as you know, one of its many austerity measures that have come in place in the last year, to significantly raise the tuition fees for universities. So we, you know, universities in this country are, although relatively autonomous, they're also sort of state controlled. So it's not quite the same as in America where you have these astronomical university fees at some places and smaller ones elsewhere. They're relatively similar across the board. And they've now gone from £3,000 to £9,000 a year overnight. So there's a lot of young people in this country who are just automatically not going to have access to university education anymore. But of course, it also will have the other effect of those people who do manage to go to university will be leaving there with a debt that leaves them very little options about what kind of life they can lead after that.
Tell us more about protesting the banks that is now so popular with the Occupy movement.
Well, it's interesting because Climate Camp always had one of its key tenets was a kind of strong statement about the relationship between climate change and capitalism, in as much so as what they would say is that capitalism is a root cause of climate change and that you can't address climate change without addressing capitalism. And I can remember conversations a few years ago within Climate Camp media meetings and things like that where they would feel that they had to be quite shy about their anti-capitalism sometimes, you know. It wasn't something that played particularly well to a wide audience. And the funny thing that's happened is that since the economic meltdown, that's the part of their message that plays the best to people now. People suddenly waking up and understanding that our banking system and our economic system are predicated on this idea of infinite growth, which is just simply not possible on a finite planet, and that we are now hitting the ceiling of that system, and we're going to have to do something very significant to address it. So that's very much a key kind of cornerstone of the Climate Camp message from the very beginning, and it's really nice now that that's the part that they find the easiest message to get out to people.
Well, I think it's kind of funny that we feel like we're stuck with these big banks, and in fact, some of the activists were super glued to the floor of the banks.
Yeah. It's good. Yeah, it's a nice little irony, isn't it?
Can you give us just another favorite story from the film?
I suppose one of my favorite things in the film was an action in which I followed a group of relatively young activists who did the action that you refer to, in which they superglued themselves to the trading floor of the Royal Bank of Scotland headquarters, as well as blockading the front of the building with step ladders and bicycle locks on their necks to the step ladders so that they couldn't be moved. And it was a relatively spiky, as they say, action. You know, this is quite a serious thing to do, and it took a lot of guts to do it. But the average age of the people on the action was probably about 19 or 20. So these were people ranging from 15 years old to, you know, their early 20s. And they allowed me to document their process from the beginning, largely because they wanted to show people that nobody had put them up to this. This was completely their idea. The plan was concocted by them and the whole thing orchestrated by them, and all using consensus, so non-hierarchically with no leadership structure. And they were very proud of that, and I was very proud watching them do it because they did such an amazingly good job of it. And in the film, it comes about halfway through the film, and I think it's the place where you really begin to see that these kids aren't just talking this. This is something that they're really living, and that it's really kind of building a completely different way looking forward into the future for them. After all, they are the ones who are going to end up really holding the bag on the issue of climate change into the future. It's their generation that's going to have, you know, be picking up the pieces. And yet, at the moment, they've got very little political voice. So it was amazing to watch them go out there and demand to have that voice.
I realize it's going to be a little bit difficult to finance and distribute a film like Just Do It. Can you briefly just give us a nutshell of how you met those challenges?
Well, we've engaged in crowdfunding, which is essentially accepting donations on our website, and we are still accepting donations on our website, so we do encourage people to give. At the moment, most of the money that we're trying to raise is to bring the film to America, because it's not cheap to distribute a film, unfortunately. In fact, we've discovered that it's costing us more money to distribute the film than it did to make the film. So, you know, we haven't got massive marketing budgets. We are hoping to get some good American festivals next year, and then we hope to be in the cinema. And then after that, we're going to be doing an extensive process of community screenings. So we'll be encouraging people to put together their own screenings, and we can facilitate that and help that to happen. So it's a kind of tiered level. And then, of course, we'll be doing DVDs and online. And there will be a Creative Commons release of the film. I don't know if your audience is familiar with Creative Commons, but that'll be a free-to-share, peer-to-peer sharing copy of the film. And we are at the moment encouraging all the occupations, all the Occupy, Boston, New York, you know, Wall Street, LA, to show the film. And we've had quite a lot of take-up on that. We've offered it to waive the fee and let them show it for free, because I think those are our people and we want them to see it for sure.
Well, that sounds like a good opportunity to ask you to give us your website.
Yes. www.justdoitfilm.com.
Justdoitfilm.com. That's pretty simple. I think we can get that. Well, as we wrap up, Emily, James, the subjects we cover seem so bleak at times that practically nothing is being done to avert a collection of collapses and disasters. Yet you call yourself willfully optimistic. Tell us how you do that.
Well, I'm a bit stubborn, I think, is what it comes down to. Some of us are lucky enough to be optimists, and, you know, some of us suffer being pessimists. I certainly have my pessimistic moments, and you're right, it can be very, very difficult to be realistically looking at and confronting the problems in front of us and knowing how far we are away from a solution, and that can be very hard. But sometimes you just have to decide that you're going to be optimistic, because there's no point in trying if you don't have any optimism left. And certainly that's a kind of attitude that we've employed in many moments on Just Do It and on the production, because there have been a number of times where we could see no way forward and we had no idea how the film was going to get out and get seen. And yet here we are, it's finished. It's been out in the UK in the cinemas and had an amazing response, and we're really looking forward to taking it to the rest of the world. So we don't have the money to do that at all today, and I think that's where the willful optimism comes into play. You know, you make the plans, you decide what it is that you want to achieve, and then you retrofit everything else.
You have been visiting with Emily James, maker of the new film Just Do It. Find out more at justdoitfilm.com. Emily, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
We're here in Oakland at the Bay Localize Resilient Communities Convening, and I'm speaking with Caroline Staten. Your badge says you're from Transition US. What is Transition US?
Transition US is a nonprofit, and it's the national hub of a global movement. And the transition movement is in 34 countries, in 14 languages, and in the US, 31 states, and we just passed the 100th transition initiative, which is the city of Lawrence, Kansas, was the 100th.
And when did that happen?
About a month ago. Now, by the end of this week, we'll be at 105. transition initiatives in 31 states across the country, with 300 to 400 more in formation at this time. The largest is Transition LA. There's 13 million people in the LA basin. And the smallest is My Canopy, Florida, that just has a post office, and all scales in between.
And where are these transitions popping up from? Who's emerging in the leadership? What kinds of organizations are spawning them, or are they individuals who find out about it? What do you see in terms of trends?
Not exactly a trend, but what transition is, it's someone gets concerned about the future. They see the writing on the wall. They see that there's definitely climactic effects that are already happening. Highest heat records across the board during this past summer. Lots of floods, droughts, hurricanes, tornadoes, etc. And people that are paying attention are realizing that it really is the end of cheap, easy-to-get oil, and fuel prices will go up. And there could be resource wars. Perhaps we already are in them, in terms of how some people are framing the war in Iraq. So people are increasingly concerned. They're not seeing that government is doing anything. They don't feel like they can do anything that's substantive alone. So they're getting together with other people. So it's when that clustering starts to happen, that's the beginning of a transition initiative. And what we do is we work with small groups to just sort of develop their muscle, to engage more of their community, to really envision what their future could be like post-peak oil, and really looking at the vulnerabilities in their systems, and getting to work on shoring up and making resilient systems in their local place that they care about, that they know the most about. And they aren't waiting for government. They aren't doing it alone. They're doing it with others, and they're finding that there's so much power and so much passion in people getting together to make their communities better that, by and large, people are having the best time of their lives dealing directly with the most dire situation we've ever had to face.
So if I were a person and I were hearing you on the radio and I'm sitting alone and I completely identify with what you're saying, and I called you up and I said, I want to start a transition in my town, but I don't know where to start, what would you tell me? To have a potluck? Would you tell me to look at your website? What would you tell me to do?
I'd suggest a few things. I'd say, have you read the Transition Handbook? That's a great place to start.
Where is that?
It's downloadable from the Transition Network site, and it's also available for purchase through any outlet. To get together with a few people and use the discussion guide that the folks of Transition Seattle put together, and go through it chapter by chapter and have discussions. And pretty soon you'll be seeing that other people are interested in what you're finding out in this cluster of groups. And they want to have a discussion group, so that's a good way to start. That's one way. We have a number of webinars and teleconference calls each month. You can plug in. There's no charge. One of the calls that we have each month is sort of an open audio open space, so you can bring up your questions and the group will provide their ideas and their what they've done in their place. So you can get, everyone leaves always having some new ideas and energy and excitement. We have tons of resources on our website. A lot of the resources are developed from the field, from the people that are doing the work and what's worked for them, like how to get to know your neighbors. Here are the five questions that are really good icebreakers. Here's using emergency preparedness and what's available through fire departments to begin a process with your neighbor.
And since we're here today with Bay Localized specifically, we should probably put a plug in for their community resilience toolkit, which is free and downloadable on their website, which is baylocalized.org. Well, Caroline Staton, I want to thank you very much on behalf of Radio EcoShock for spending some time with us today.
That was Bay Area activist and reporter Karen Nyhus. Thank you for listening. Join us next week on Green 960 San Francisco.